Games played with or using machines have fascinated me pretty much all of my life. I played dodgeball. I was conned into doing Little League for a season. But the real joy for me when it came to playing games was machines. Whether they were a computer or an arcade machine, I really enjoyed sitting down, being given a strict set of rules, and then trying in some way to overcome them, one quarter or maybe 1 hour at a time. This is Jason Scott. You're listening to the Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It podcast, a podcast about history, technology, and getting out of debt. Thanks to Jeff Atwood, Daniel Boyd, and the hundreds of other supporters who are helping me in paying off my debts and making this podcast possible. Where even to start with video games? I guess with my first one. Near where my parents were living at the time in the late 1970s, an arcade popped up. And I think one of the aspects of arcades that has been mostly forgotten is that video game arcades, as opposed to places along the boardwalk that had games for over a century, video arcades were truly a fad business. That is, you would have somebody who recognized that video games were making a lot of money and were very popular and attracted a lot of customers. And so people would lease buildings or parts of buildings, and they would throw in anywhere between 5, 15, 20, or 30 video arcade machines. And then that would be about it. And then they'd wait to see who would show up, and usually they'd make rent. The places that they rented were the kind of places that don't get all the great business. They often didn't have any kind of kitchen, so they couldn't be used for food preparation, and they would be in out-of-the-way places, the parts of the mall or the section of the town that nobody went to, so the prices were pretty low. As long as the machines were there, people would come. Now, owners of arcades might go the extra mile and paint in some sort of space theme or get in some blacklight carpet or fill the place with music and merriment in such a way that you felt you were part of a greater whole. But it wasn't required. A lot of times, all you needed were functioning lights, a bunch of video games, and a door that shut at night. And the place that I went to that was my first video arcade, I couldn't even tell you if it had a name. It was a small building, one that's still there in my hometown, and it had a weird little sloped roof, and they had shoved something like 30 video games into it. And my parents took me there because I think my father wanted to play some video games and see what it was like. And they had all sorts of video games that I never saw again for a very, very long time. The most notable one being Cinematronic Space, this gargantuan port of a mainframe program that, to a kid who's only about 9 years old, looks like something from truly another world. It was this large square screen and these weird little controls. And why was somebody making a machine to play games? It blew my mind. It was an absolutely foreign concept. And after my father tinkered around with some of the games, we left. But that was the end of it for Jason. Jason had found a lifelong love. Video game arcades were everywhere for a while because of that low overhead. And there was one in almost every mall near me. There would be video arcade machines in pizza parlors and in department stores and diners and ice cream places. Everybody had to have a video game, and every video game had to be placed right where everyone could see it. Video games, after all, are attractors. It's called an attract mode because this brightly colored video screen is telling you that fun could be had for a simple quarter. Everybody wants to claim that they lived through the golden age, but I really feel that I did for video arcades. And there were a couple years in there where every time I would get my parents to take me to video arcades, I would see a machine with a structure and play rules that had never been seen before. You might see Zaxxon, or Centipede, or Kix, or Pac-Man, or Zaxxon, or Joust for the very first time. These games now all seem to make sense. They've become part of the culture. But imagine walking in and to one side, usually prominently placed, is a game you'll never have seen before and one which you can play for one quarter. This happened time and time again. It was a dopamine burst that just kept on paying off. And let's be clear, I wasn't great at these games. I was okay. I'd play some more than others. I'd be better at some than others. Robotron would kick my butt, but then I would sort of get my act together. I would have games like Centipede that make you feel pretty smart initially until it turns real and then you're pretty much dead. Pac-Man was one I could read about, learn the patterns of, and just be a pain in the ass. Atari Food Fight was bizarre controls hooked up to a bizarre game, and it disappeared pretty quickly, and it was years and years before I ever saw it again. Now, I owe everybody an arcade documentary, and I'm working very hard to bring it together. But one of the things about the arcade documentary is that I am focused primarily on the space of arcades. I'm less interested in doing a documentary that tells you that Pac-Man came out and it was very popular, and then people played it a lot, and then they didn't play it as much, but now they still remember it. I'm just not interested in doing another documentary about sales, sales numbers, sales results, and sales decline. I want to make something about the place. Why is it that we can take a dingy, dark, useless space that nobody wants to rent it for almost nothing, throw 10 lit boxes into them, and suddenly it is the happening place for a lot of people for a very long time. That's where I'm going with it. We'll see how it goes. Conversely, of course, there were the home computers, and with the home computers came home video games. My first computer, which is a Commodore PET, had a few games that I somehow acquired, and I've completely forgotten how, that you would load up on cassette. So you would press play, and it would read it in anywhere between 3 and 5 minutes, and you would suddenly be playing something called Hunt the Wumpus, or Cat and Mouse. Hunt the Wumpus is a seminal work in gaming. In its strictest form, it was a maze game. You would be put into a room, told that there were multiple exits, and then you would be asked which numbered exit did you want to go to. And whenever one of those exits had a hazard, you would be warned with some sort of line like, you can feel a draft, or you can hear some growling nearby. So it was a game of randomness and bizarre dungeon crawling, but it was also so compact in the experience that I really enjoyed it. And there was a cat and mouse game where it would generate a maze, which was itself pretty amazing on a Commodore PET, and you would be simply a letter M moving through the maze to try to get out, while a K would travel around, K being for cat. So the cat, it turned out, had pretty basic artificial intelligence, as they say. It was an algorithm that just took every left. So whenever it came up to some sort of choice, it would always take the left one. Now, I didn't know anything about programming at the time, so to me it was magical that this basic program was able to give you a full video arcade experience on this little machine in my house for free. As many times as I ran it, it was ready to go. And when I moved from a Commodore PET to my father's IBM PC, the IBM PC had a whole range of DOS programs. And again, this is way in the beginning, so graphics were scant. Text ruled the day. And while these games lacked all of the pizzazz and the sound and the music of the arcades, the fact that they were right there, arm's length at any time, made them magical in a different way for me. I wrote a few games, which sadly have been lost to time. On the Internet Archive are remnants of how DOS programs were in the early 1980s. They would sometimes be miraculous in terms of their coding. There's a game called Snack Attack, which was done by none other than Michael Abrash, who was one of the major architects behind Quake and the Oculus Rift. But here, he's just making a wind-up whale that plays a relatively weird game of Pac-Man. There was a game for the Apple called Sabotage, and this thing was everywhere. You didn't get to move. You were a turret at the bottom of the screen, and then planes would fly by, and then these guys would be dropped down on parachutes. You had to shoot the guys who were coming down on the parachutes because if enough landed, they would gang up and destroy your turret. Initially, it was easy to shoot them, but then, of course, it would become faster and faster. And there was even an interesting little aspect, which was you could shoot their parachutes out and they would fall down. So you could focus on that and be able to make the game even more needlessly violent and abstractly vicious. As the bounty has run over at the archive and tens of thousands of software programs have come marching back from the graveyard, it's been interesting to do exploration into what were really good games, which ones were not so good, and why did this guy think that this needed to be anywhere? And through that quality range, we learn how people treat machines and what their feelings are on what games are. In the computer sphere, without that monetary aspect of requiring you to dump more quarters in, and I am speaking about the 1980s, there's a whole sense of expansiveness and letting you work your way through things that could be hours or days to get done. There have been video games that I've spent 6 months trying to totally understand. There have been other ones that were barely an afternoon, but were such a dense, packed experience that really who could argue? I think one of the things that comes out about games is that graphics and sound are great, but they're not the ending of everything. A game that requires only eye candy to make you put your quarter in won't keep getting more quarters, and it won't get more of your time if it's on a home computer. If, however, it has a sense of bringing your skills into the mix to respond to them and make your game even more fun, I think those are the ones that we look back on as classics. The biggest lost metric is time. It used to be eons to download a program off of a bulletin board system, and so you had to choose what kind of programs you wanted, and there would often be just one line. It would say, simple Pac-Man clone, or fire at the ships until you win, and you had to decide, maybe with a very short time limit, which of these programs you wanted to download and make the center of your evening. Shareware was an interesting model. You would make a program available, and maybe you would just encourage people to spread it around. Or you would say, if you really enjoyed it, maybe send me a little bit of money, or write me a postcard. And so these games would go out into the world with all sorts of hopeful messages in them from the creators. And some of them would be truly original works, and some of them would be derivative beyond belief. It was always fun to find a weird clone of something you saw in the arcades, to play a Joust clone, to play a Defender clone, I mean to play one of the endless Pac-Man clones out there, maybe with a new rule set or with enemies you didn't expect. You know, there was a case of both wanting to recreate the arcade experience, but also hopefully wishing for something really new to come after you had spent anywhere between 5 minutes and 3 hours downloading something. That time metric is absolutely lost now. I mean, I don't want to go back to it. The fact that you look at something and then within maybe a minute you're playing it and you know where you stand with it, I mean, that's a precious use of human life. It's when you spend overnight and you set up your modem and you hope nobody picks it up, and overnight the program comes in, you boot it up, and you are either soaring with happiness or disappointed beyond belief. It's a character building exercise, but it's not necessary for us to go back to that. One trick that has definitely been lost to time is that you would have cases where you couldn't download any programs off of a bulletin board system unless you uploaded something good. This was especially the case in pirate bulletin boards. They would have ratios, and so they would say every 3 or 4 programs you download, you have to upload another program, or we're not going to let you download anymore. And some of them even implemented ratios for messages, which, if you think about it, does not lead to quality messages. So it would have to be something pretty good to get them to let you in. And so what people would sometimes do is they would invent sequels. People would say, well, what programs do you have? And there would be some program out there that was called something like Golf Master. And you would say, well, I've got Golf Master 2. And they would be like, Golf Master 2? I've never seen that before. Definitely upload it. And you would temporarily get your ratio until the sysop figured out what you had just done. With the advent of the internet in college for me, I moved to a different kind of game, games that were multi-user, where the thing you were fighting was another person, and not a person next to you in a fighting game, but a person who could be anywhere in the world making you miserable. Being able to play people I didn't know in ways I didn't understand and have them totally mop the floor with me and then learning the skills and coming back, I mean, those are some of my best memories. I got the Quake tech demo when it came out, and when I was able to play Quake over the internet in the late 1990s, I mean, what an experience to be able to find that there were these servers that people could connect to and play against you. It's become pedestrian, but it was mind-blowing. There will be, I think, always a market and always a urge to find ways to connect with people and make them miserable. So, pulling it back a little bit, I think what I'm trying to get at here is that games are in many ways a throwaway product. They're something that you're supposed to do as a kind of side recreation before getting back to the stuff of life. But for many of us, the games are life. I mean, life can be something full of disappointments and boredom and giving the impression of very little mystery, even though we all know mystery abounds everywhere. Games, however, package that mystery up into a tight, concentrated box that you know will be there the minute that you turn on the switch or put in the quarter or put in the floppy disk. It's an engagement machine. It is a never-ending puzzle that beckons you. And for a lot of us, myself included, there have been times in our life where we needed that more than anything. The sense that there was this confined world that, while definitely not one that would help a career or necessarily brag about to your family, it was still your accomplishment and your domain that you controlled. I can't overstate that leg up in finding your place in the world. Can it go wrong? Of course. Can it go really right? Yes, as well. And when I look back on video games and computer games, there are experiences that I still remember to this day, and they blow me away. There was a time that I was playing a game called Road Rash. Now, Road Rash was a pretty generic game. You were basically a motorcyclist and you were racing other motorcyclists, and it was a game where you were looking straight down the horizon and you would ride with your motorcycle. And the little thing that it had that was different than some racing games was that your motorcyclist could kick other motorcyclists. So you would be driving along at 70 miles an hour and there'd be a person next to you, and then you would kick him and that would be the end of his game. And so you would drive along, and in fact, sometimes you would even pass policemen and they would race after you. And if you slowed down enough because the cops smacked into you or got in front of you, you would be arrested. On the other hand, you could punch a cop. We'll debate that some other time, but the fact that you were both trying to not smack into buildings, keep to the top of the pack, and punch people out led to this interesting situation where you could punch somebody and they would fly up a little bit, and when they touched the road, they would disappear. In other words, it had programming in there for the physics, simple as they were, to go up in the air and then be stopped by the ground. And there was one time that I was driving along at top speed, something like 130 or 140 miles per hour on my little video game bike, and I smacked into somebody. I look back and I don't know why it didn't make me crash, but I smacked into somebody and then I kept driving. And I didn't know where the person had gone. They had not flown up. They had not hit the ground. So I drove along, And 10 seconds later, the person dropped out of the sky, hit the ground, and disappeared. Almost one or two frames. And I look back on that as, wow, that algorithm just gave it a number so huge, and it put somebody 2 miles up into the air and just let them drop down. And I could not stop laughing. I just dropped my controller in hysterics. That's a game that gives you a memory. I love it when games give you a memory. There's a whole subgenre of game mechanic that is my personal favorite. It's in Super Mario Sunshine, it's in Hexen, it's in Fez. It's actually in a small set of games, but it's ones where you return to a place in the game. You know, most games have it that you go from level 1 to level 2 to level 3. You never develop a relationship with those worlds other than as a barrier. You land in Jungle World or Candy World or Computer World. You get through these worlds and then you move on to the next world. You don't see them again. And there's a small number of games, like the ones I've mentioned, where you return over and over again to the original lobby or space that you were in the beginning, but the nature has changed. You've gotten a skill you didn't have. A part of the lobby has changed architecture to reflect the plot, and so your relationship to a place you've already been has been modified. It's essentially the plot of Lord of the Rings. You go places and then return again, and change has occurred. That is by far my favorite mechanic. But don't think that I'm going to lie down on any other kind of game. I love learning a new set of weird skills from some sort of bizarre indie game and then finding it going further and further and further in that direction until you can't believe where you've ended up. Playing games like The Witness or Steven's Sausage Roll or Turing Test or, of course, Portal. Games where you have to puzzle out and understand how the world works. How can I not enjoy that? And maybe that's where I stop, to tell you that technology is many things to us, and as we watch it transform us, it's going to have a bigger and bigger part in all aspects of life. But so far, in my world, I thank these machines and the people who have created them and programmed them and have constantly been trying to innovate and make things even more immersive, because you have improved my life. I have become a different person due to all of these so-called toys playing a part, and I look forward, as long as I live, to experiencing what's new, what's next, what makes me think, what makes me better, and how late can I afford to stay up tonight? This is Jason Scott. You've been listening to the Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It podcast. Thanks to James Bakoyanu, Sam Johnston, and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and LibrePay and PayPal who help make this podcast happen. If you're not aware that I do ask for people to donate money, there is podcast.textfiles.com. This is money that goes towards me paying off debt. I've had a number of bills in the last 2 months that have just disappeared out of my life, and I continue to be able to make financial decisions for my own health and happiness, and I cannot thank you enough for making it such a reality. See you next week.